You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, welcoming you to another edition of The Daily Nationalist. Today's date is the 1st of August, 2024, here on Radio Albion. Today, hopefully I won't go over too much, but I want to deal with what I think are two interrelated issues. The theft of Russia's foreign assets and the Great Reset overall. The fact that no one denies that this is a theft suggests that this is the status of property, our property rights under an oligarchy. So I want to quote from a few people, and the first is Robert Burrows from an article he wrote in 2022. And I've quoted Burrows before, and this is how he starts off. In 2020, under the cover of the virus vaccine narrative, the global elite launched its long-planned coup to capture total control of the human population. Building on a history that dawned with human civilization around 5,000 years ago, and at least 50 years in the final planning, progressive efforts by elites in local, national, and now global contexts to kill off undesired populations and enslave those left alive are now culminating. Now, none of that really should be new to anybody. But the awareness of this kind of thing is almost non-existent. Ask someone the core of the Great Reset and they really won't be able to answer you. And I say that for educated as well as uneducated people. So Burroughs purports to explain what's happening, and he does a decent job of it. Now, if you remember, when we first dealt with the Great Reset, headquartered at Davos, you know, the World Economic Forum, we're really talking about the regime as a whole. The New World Order is over, and that has led to, like, the modern leading to the postmodern. New World Order has led to the Great Reset. When we first spoke of it, I cited the idea that it will start with a forgiveness of all of our private debts, and in exchange for that, they would take all of our private assets, and things would be administered rather than lived or function. And you know, eugenics is a big part of this. You talk about things like rights or duties or property, anything like that under an oligarchy, it's very different than the much older modern concept. Because an oligarchy is inherently deceptive. One of the big differences between the New World Order and the Great Reset is technology. Now, I'm still very skeptical of what this new technology really is, but I'm not skeptical as to whatever it is, how it's going to be used. And technology is at the absolute core here. 5G, various new weapons, AI, big data, nanotechnology, biotechnology, the Internet of Things, the Internet of Bodies, etc. Mass surveillance, the metaverse, all of these buzzwords that, as they're defined by some of these organizations, don't seem to say much. To subvert identity, freedom, dignity, volition, even privacy, again, is nothing new. This is the transition ideologically from the modern to the postmodern. The modern was nominalist and dealt with a word or an image that actually corresponded to an object. Here, we're talking about a word or an image that corresponds to nothing but itself. In fact, it corresponds to a network rather than an actual object. And Burroughs says, and rightly so, we're talking about this transhuman enslavement, the imprisonment, the depopulation. And he calls it a coup. It's a revolution that comes straight out of the mentality of capitalism. They call it the fourth industrial revolution. What we do, of course, is counter-revolution. And 2020, as we all know, was a huge part of this. At international organizations, whether it be the various UN bureaucracies or the WHO, relevant corporations, you know, media especially, pharmaceuticals, high tech, and of course, national governments. Now, most of this, you know, when I define the word regime, I defined it many years before the Great Reset had come into existence. Synonyms for it would be the global elite, the ruling class. The regime refers to not just governments, militaries, but it refers to the entire infrastructure of ideology and intellect, such as the media, academia, economics, you know, finance, the big banks, manufacturing, various parts of the world. Burroughs also mentions a group called the Council for Inclusive Capitalism, which, frankly, I had forgotten about. They don't get a lot of attention. By their own admission, they're created by one of the female signs of the Rothschild family. Every major corporation is involved in it. And like so much of the Great Reset, I've been reading a lot of their predictions on their forum and things like that. They don't say much. But whether it be the World Economic Forum or the Council for Inclusive Capitalism, they say a lot of the same things, which is another way of not saying anything at all. It's a series of buzzwords. And I get to that here in a minute. Now, Burroughs makes the claim that there's no legal way to fight this, because they define, in the postmodern mentality, what legal is, what corruption is, what rights or duties are, what property is. I don't believe the regime is insane. I do believe, however, they are sociopathic in the traditional sense of the term. You also know, and Burroughs has come on board recently, I've been saying for so many years now, several decades now, that liberal democracy or democratic processes are a sham. I've dealt with the Federalist, Anti-Federalist debate right after the, or during the American Revolution, and they predicted a lot of this stuff. That the division of branches of government over time, especially in a high-tech world, does nothing to limit power. Mass media, centralized control over images didn't exist back then. But whether it be under the old aristocracy, a mass industrial democracy, or now the postmodern oligarchy, terms are not going to be defined in the same way. It's another reason why reading their stuff, you know, it's like reading Marxists. It's very difficult. You have to have a decoder ring to know what they mean by certain terms, or if they mean anything by certain terms. 2020 was absolutely essential because, as I've said at the time, I'm pretty sure I was the first to say this, government simply did what they were told, both for their own interests as well as, you know, from the WHO, etc., the Gates Foundation, all of these interlocking organizations forming the regime. I spoke both on this show and on my own and written many places, but Patreon and elsewhere, that, you know, I went through the emergency legislation, both to federal and state governments, and nowhere does it give the state the right to do what it did. Now, of course, they'll admit that lockdowns did nothing except destroy things. But the point was that no state has the legal right to do this. Now, states are normally perceived as doing whatever they want, and that's become part of the day-to-day life. And therefore, things like censorship and the tight centralization of technocratic rule all really reached a blatant apogee in 2020. The manipulation of terms, you know, the anti-vaxxer or the conspiracy theorist, this use of labels that don't really refer to anything, the word racist or sexist, these don't refer to any specific action. And that's, you know, it's a spectrum of meaning that the regime uses for its own benefit. But all this comes down to the fact that liberal democracy doesn't mean anything when the regime, you know, uses the word democracy. So if you've seen the campaign ads from this idiot vice president who doesn't know a damn thing, she says taking the election from Trump is saving our democracy. Well, of course, the election is going to be rigged one way or the other. It may not be rigged enough. They may have far more confidence now than they did years ago. Because the rigging of 2020 was so blatant and obvious. You really have to be trying to avoid that information to accept that it was anything other than that. Democracy must mean something other than your normal democratic procedure. In fact, it doesn't refer to procedures at all. It's an ideological idea. And he mentions the assassination of Shinzo Abe, the former prime minister of Japan. He was, according to him anyway, a resistor of the regime. And assassination, invasion, sanctions, whatever, is how the regime deals with opposition. Those successfully fighting the regime, I think of Putin and Lukashenko, just to name two, are extremely popular. And how easy it is to write them out of, global existence by simply ignoring them, except when it comes to making war on them. I'm making it a point to say that the Great Reset is intentionally symbolized by the war in Ukraine, which they simply could make up as they see fit, and the theft of these assets. Using phrases like secret government, a ruling class, a regime. You know, the regime operates by stealth. It can't come out and call itself, you know, we rule you. You know, they have no right to be where they are. Therefore, they have to manipulate you. And this is why that kind of oligarchy is inherently deceptive. And at one level or another, that's going to be the case until people simply get used to it. And this is at a global level. You know, the World Economic Forum's Young Global Leaders Program, the Schwarzman Scholars Program, this is how, at least at the top levels, institutions can be subverted from the top down. The lockdowns prove that it was very easy to alter the definition of law or freedom or speech or assembly. Remember, only the violence against white people, which was a key part of the 2020 experience after the so-called killing of what's-his-name, which, of course, he died of bad health. He died of fentanyl. Cops didn't kill him, but it didn't matter. Nothing made sense about that case, but he was convicted anyway. But importantly, that was the only kind of assembly that the regime accepted. No one ever talked about that they're not wearing masks or anything like that. So it's not just a complete repression, but it's a redefinition of things like freedom of assembly or freedom of speech. Now, he also quotes the constitutional lawyer John Whitehead, and he quotes him this way. Here's what he says. Not only have the federal and state governments unraveled the constitutional fabric of the nation with lockdown mandates that sent the economy into a tailspin and wrought havoc with our liberties, but they have almost persuaded the citizenry to depend on the government for financial handouts, medical intervention, protection, and sustenance. This past year under lockdown, of course this was written a few years ago, was a lesson in many things, but most of all, it was a lesson in how to indoctrinate a populace to love and obey Big Brother. And Burroughs goes on to say that Big Brother is not a government. It's this network of elite figures and institutions largely hidden from public view. And you don't hear much about them. The Council for Inclusive Capitalism, where you have every major corporate leader and a few central bankers headed by Rothschild talking about stakeholder capitalism and rejecting GDP and ignoring, you know, things like inflation, instead promoting the leftist ideology. People call it woke ideology to keep the left from being tarred with it, but it's simply postmodern leftism. The distinctions between liberalism or you know, materialist Marxism have gone out the window. But that council has Bank of America, a bunch of banks on it. I think Visa is on it. They come right out and say that they don't really need governments anymore. Governments to them are just a bodyguard. It offers the physical and bureaucratic force needed from time to time to promote their agenda. This organization says this social engineering, which they've talked about for many decades, but only now are able to ram through, that corporations, that this is a privatized operation. We really don't need the state as such, which is the very definition of what we call a shadow government, shadow ruling apparatus. It's a massive corporate cabal that has media as some of its most important pillars. But the old modern conception of rights has to do with, in the Western world, has to do with procedures. Democracy used to be defined as a set of procedures where through freedom of speech and assembly and then voting, one candidate or party or another is going to be elected, and hence it has some sort of a mandate. It doesn't mean that anymore. People still think it does, but it doesn't. Procedures don't deal with the outcome. The concept of procedural justice just means that if you go through the motions, whatever comes out must be just. So long as you're given, you know, say in criminal law, everything from cross-examination to having a lawyer present at questioning, all of these things, these are procedures, filing motions, that so long as they're not repressed in any way, whatever the outcome is, must be just. And that is not the case anymore. Legality is a lot like the old Soviet legality. It has nothing to do with written law, because oligarchy and deceit don't like the idea of written law. They do love the idea of completely redefining terms such as law itself. And what he's trying to say here is that political activism doesn't do much. The only political activism that works is like the climate people that are subsidized and mobilized by the regime itself. Now, I've never voted. Some of you know I have several essays as to why, some long ones, as to why I've never voted, because no one is ruling in my name here. But if you vote, that's what you're essentially saying. But politicians and university professors, especially media people, whether it be entertainment or so-called news media, their job is to conceal and defend this mass elite network. I want to quote Burroughs again in this respect. If you think the law is really concerned with justice, then ask yourself why poverty and homelessness are not made illegal, and those who suffer poverty and homelessness immediately provided with social housing and an adequate income. Of course, this would be easy if military budgets for killing were eliminated and international conflicts were addressed meaningfully, or the estimated $32 trillion of illegal wealth hidden in offshore tax havens was made available for the benefit of humanity. It would be very easy simply for these elites to pay off everyone's mortgages. But that's not how they became elites in the first place. But the point of it all is, the regime has no connection to the rule of law. No one's actually elected, because a candidate only exists if the media says they do. And I've been through that in much detail. Debate is at such a low level, and this includes sometimes in committee hearings. Really, committee hearings, if they're true experts, are the only time you really get any kind of serious discussion, but that's tightly controlled by the committee chair anyway. They make a big deal about ultra-transparency. And in fact, I want to talk about something that mentions this. And it was from the World Economic Forum in 2019. So this is prior to the lockdowns. The essay is, "What If We Get Things Right? Visions for 2030. This is on their website. It's in one of the forums that they sponsor. But I like the idea, and you know, they use a lot of sloganeering and buzzwords that really, in many cases, only they know the true meaning of, but I have the feeling I know. Let me read how this starts out. Again, 2019. Here is one vision of Co-topia. You walk out of your door in the morning into a green and livable city. You can choose to call upon a car. An algorithm has calculated the smartest route for the vehicle, and it picks up a few other people on the way. Since the city council has banned private cars in the city, tons of new mobility services have arrived. It is cheaper for you not to own your own car, and it reduces congestion, so you arrive at your destination more quickly and don't have to spend time looking for parking. There are a lot fewer cars on the streets, and the rest are electric. All electricity is green, by the way. Now, that's item one in this visions for 2030. And it fits perfectly with what I'm talking about as the administered life, the administered existence. It's not a life that's led. There's no virtue or vice. It's administered by an algorithm known really only to a handful of high-tech elites. But their utopia is, for example, that the city council has banned private cars. As if the city council actually has that kind of authority. And it isn't some kind of a justification for the modern way of life. It isn't. But there's a big difference between the modern, and this is a classic postmodern idea. Now, this is section 9. And they're talking about the improvement of mental health. The Great Reset has a huge psychological component. Let me read this. Bear with me here. I see a world where technology, such as a smartphone, improves mental health and reduces suicide risk. Sensors in smartphones combined with AI will allow software to create buddies that will assimilate mental health knowledge about each person and then help them navigate safely day to day. This so-called digital phenotyping uses both passively collected data, voice analysis, cognitive indicators, and self-reporting from smartphones, and it will yield these predictions and monitoring capabilities within a decade. I predict that people around the world will have continuous, immediate, and effective access to digital therapeutics for mental health. Support will be offered proactively and just in time. The clunky and rigid digital interventions we have today will be transformed into interactive games and experiences that deliver therapeutic content enjoyably, by stealth, using technology such as virtual reality. I see people having access to mental health dashboards on their devices so that they can share their data, which they own, when and how they wish. I see more research into how people relate and learn to live as cyborgs from an early age. I see the potential of social networks to be used to reduce stigma and promote understanding. I have a list of 30 things that they want to see happen, and this is number 9. I'm tempted to read it again because this is a document that's not cited very much. They have some their predictions document. I don't know who the I is in I See a World. The I has to be some institutional World Economic Forum. This is on their site, and they have written this. But I don't know who I is. But the phone will be used, again, to collect data like voice analysis and cognitive indicators. They're mapping the brain and this self-reporting from smartphones. And they're going to predict what you're going to do. And they actually use the word prediction. And they use the term monitoring capability. That's the only way that, as I say, support will be offered proactively and just in time. And this is going to be presented as a game. And it's not going to be immediately known to the patient. And the word patient is specifically appropriate here because they explicitly say it's going to be done enjoyably and by stealth. So you're not going to know really what you're doing. Now, of course, they have this line, you know, they could share their data, which they own, in other words, which they possess, and they can use when and how they wish. Well, terms like sharing and ownership and even data can be redefined. That's simply something that I have to kind of put in there. And then, you know, out of nowhere, they use the word cyborg from an early age. And the nature of these social networks, which, of course, are administered and purged occasionally by the regime itself. Let me read one more thing from this. If old age represents the accumulation of every advantage and disadvantage built up throughout a person's life, whether economic, social, environmental, or behavioral, then surely the solution to healthy aging lies in a whole life approach. However, concerns about a patient's financial, social, emotional health often emerge too late, as well as after a serious medical diagnosis. A holistic, multidisciplinary, and person-centered model of care can ensure dignity, comfort, and well-being during the final phase of a patient's life. My vision for 2030 is that these comprehensive and wellness-oriented aspects of care are integrated much earlier into each person's life and become a part of primary care. As a global burden of disease shifts towards a non-communicable disease, much more can be done around the world to enhance the capacity of the primary care sector to care for a person's overall welfare. This approach would include addressing socioeconomic constraints and their impact on lifestyle choices, things like diet, exercise, alcohol, tobacco consumption, mental health issues such as depression, stress, and loneliness, and other social and environmental barriers, all of which are proven to have significant repercussions for the aging process. As an easily accessible point of contact, the healthcare system for millions of people, primary care providers hold the key to shaping the aging process for the better. Beyond preventative healthcare and screening for early disease detection and management, how can sound policies empower primary care providers to offer services like lifestyle counseling or tailored care plans that promote better health proactively? It's time for policymakers and industry leaders to reimagine the way societies structure, finance, and deliver primary care to promote healthy aging for all. And now that's number 17. This really doesn't have anything to do with aging. It's saying that they're not separating any phase of a person's life, that they are going to control what aging is, and it's going to come just like the previous number 9, where all of the data about a person's lifestyle is going to lead to some kind of customized care plan. And I have the feeling that the word care means a lot more than just healthcare. In fact, they separate care from healthcare several times here. Lifestyle counseling. This is pure totalitarianism. Now, what does this have to do with the $300 billion of Russian financial assets? Well, it's part of the redefinition of what's good and bad, of what exists and what doesn't exist. Now, apparently these are Russian state assets, although it doesn't mean they're necessarily all owned by the state. $260 of the $300 billion is held in Europe, in Belgium near Brussels, NATO's home base. $5 billion is in the USA and is frozen. So apparently, and I've been very, very suspicious about this whole thing from the beginning, NATO countries have already begun the process of transferring the seized and at one time frozen $300 billion Russian assets to Ukraine. Now, apparently this is supposed to be a funding problem. Although, frankly, this is a drop in the bucket. Spring 2024, this year, Congress passed another $61 billion for Ukraine, and Europe added another $5 billion to this, funding the war up until 2024. Of course, this implies that wars are centrally about money. But of course, we know that this war has been over for a very long time. Now, funding this war is the problem. The Biden proposal has to do with this freezed money. There is no gold. It's foreign currency, although these aren't any physical objects. See, when you talk about an account that gets frozen, it's a place where someone would have jurisdiction that you can't take anything out of it or use it in any way, or else there would be sanctions. But that's not the case here. There's no jurisdiction, and it's usually a court matter, not just a foreign policy establishment matter. Back in 2022, this $300 billion in assets were frozen. But mostly, these are numbers on a computer screen. The $5 billion is in American banks. And what they're going to do was convert it to dollars and use it for Ukraine. Now, BlackRock's proposal, they call it the Biden proposal, like he has any idea what's going on, gets me suspicious because it's raising $50 billion from private investors for Ukraine. The bonds would be issued, bought by investors, and then the $50 billion raised put into the Ukraine Defense Fund created by Congress and distributed. And the World Bank would act as distributor of these funds. The Ukrainian government, which really doesn't exist, would pay the interest on the bonds every year. And of course, Ukraine's going to default on it, but these are guaranteed bonds. The state, or that is me and you, would reimburse the investors. So American investors would make the money, and possibly both American and European taxpayers will be stuck with the bill. And there really is no full plan here. Why are they even talking about a bond issue? Why wouldn't they just take this money? Now, they've claimed that there's some gold here. There is none. There is no gold held outside of Russia, and that's pretty common. It doesn't make sense. It's as if they really don't have access to this. It isn't like a judge freezing an account for some, you know, a criminal case or an escrow case. There is no matter of jurisdiction here. This is a completely privatized idea. And why are they talking about $54 billion? And of course, this is guaranteed investments. Why wouldn't they simply take the money rather than claiming that they have access to this money, these assets, these underlying assets, and then issuing a bond issuance on top of it or under its authority? It's very unclear. We know where this money goes. I've been talking about aid to Ukraine for 20 years now. No one has any idea where it goes. There is really no functional Ukrainian economy or currency or state. Whatever exists is paid for by Western taxpayers and, you know, BlackRock investments. The interest would be $4 billion yearly of the $260. So the regime is saying that we're not going to use the $260 or $300 billion 260 in EU banks. But no, there's going to be a separate bond issuance. And how and why or where Ukraine gets this cash is open to debate. So where is this $50 billion coming from? And how is this different from any other bond? You know, if the $50 billion is raised and structured, Ukraine will still have to pay back the principal, which is supposed to be $300 billion. And where is it going to get the money? It doesn't have anything. Now, there's been another of American elites that simply want to just seize the full amount. But the Europeans didn't like this idea. But somehow Ukraine is supposed to pay back this the $260 billion principal, which is never going to happen. Just to grab the, what, $260 billion outright instead of using it as collateral with which to raise a euro bond, or something like that, or an American bond issuance. And of course, they're worried about the legality here. And of course, Russia is going to respond in kind. There's still a lot of EU bank assets, everything from cash to real property in Russia, that of course, they're going to take in turn. The US doesn't have much risk in that sense. Russia has already taken assets from Deutsche Bank and Commerce Bank for reasons, of course, related to the sanctions. And there's plenty of European companies still operating in Russia. And the Russians, of course, will simply nationalize it if they go through, assuming that the Western banks really have access to this cash. Because if they did, why would they be talking about a bond issuance? And if theft, just outright seizing these assets starts with Russia, it's certainly not going to end with Russia. Other countries, of course, especially those that are not on good terms with the West, will simply take everything they have in the European market or the American market and bring it back, which is, you know, awful for a stagnant and dying European economy. There's a lot of economic effects. It sounds good to talk about $300 billion. We're just going to steal it somehow, convert it into some currency and use it in Ukraine. But that implies that there's this pile of currency sitting in a vault somewhere. And that's simply not how it works. It's going to be an excuse to issue a bond that they'll be able to profit from, and it'll be guaranteed since the Ukrainian government, to the extent that it exists at all, rather than a colonial administration, will never have to pay it. This is one of the reasons that BRICS has come into existence. American neoliberals don't seem to care about any of it. This is why BRICS has come into existence. This is why there's this challenge of the hegemony of the dollar. And frankly, this doesn't have much to do with the war as such, because we know where some of this money has gone. The Ukrainian elite, which is very Judaic, has been greatly enriched by this. I also want to make a point, which I didn't realize until fairly recently. Mohammed bin Salman, king of Saudi Arabia, has publicly stated that if Europe does this and distributes this $300 billion to Ukraine, Saudi Arabia will withdraw its assets and euros from European banks. And he especially warned the French in this respect. But the question of a bond issuance, rather than simply stealing the money, well, one way or another, if this is an asset that a bond is going to be based on, the bond then, in the case of default, is still vulnerable. So I'm very suspicious as to if this is simply a pile of currency in a bank vault that they can steal, or that the European computer system can simply keep those accounts from being accessed, which is what freezing is. But it's not like you have a physical thing there. Although I think there are some actual assets. There's just as many privately held in Russia at the moment. And very few people have bothered to consider what this is going to mean. And that's why at least the Europeans are interested in the bond issuance, because they're afraid of what other countries are going to do. And in fact, it's their taxpayers that are going to be on the hook either way, since these are guaranteed investments. One of the big situations now in American politics is that it seems that the regime is divided between anti-China and anti-Russia factions. And the Republicans seem to be saying that China is the real enemy. We need to divert resources to Taiwan or Hong Kong. There's talks in the Pentagon about trying to blockade by sea the Chinese Navy. Like, we're talking about North Korea here. They still operate under this myth that China is this fourth world backwater, incapable of defending itself. Some of you may remember my Korean War paper on one specific battle in a specific mountain range, where the U.S. and the Turks were badly beaten because they didn't think China was capable of defending itself. And everything has gotten far worse as far as the Americans are concerned. But the connection between the Great Reset and the Russian assets are that when someone is termed an enemy without any actual facts underneath it, just because they are inconvenient to the regime, they are deprived of rights. Because property rights here obviously doesn't mean anything. And they're willing to take huge risks for this symbolic victory. You know, Russia is now, the sixth largest economy in the world. $300 billion is not a big deal. But the very fact that they were trying to include gold in this, the fact that there is no gold abroad, suggests that a lot of this is wildly exaggerated. The fact that there is no underlying asset here. It's simply a media report or a claim by a politician. But that's the nature of the postmodern economy. It lives off interest on debt and fees. The plunder of public assets, as Paul Craig Roberts said, through privatization and exploitation of the developing world, using dollar-based bank loans that have to be repaid using that same currency, of course, and it won't be repaid in full. At the financialized economy rests on debt, not actual production, and certainly not on prosperity. It's based on political coercion of the dollar-indebted foreign state. And as I've said in the Ukrainian thing, there's no money. There's no functional economy. Every penny of profitable industry has been taken by the regime, which is why the East separated from the rest of Ukraine in the first place. Because they kept that from happening. Manufacturing is not the issue. But since Ukraine is in such massive debt to the West, there's not even their capital that could be seized. It's all gone. The last thing they have are their bodies. And it's Ukrainian soldiers that are repaying this debt. And when you offshore everything, when you try to destroy the white working class that was the productive class, and offshoring both sending capital to the third world, as well as bringing the third world to the U.S., bringing the third world to capital, manufacturing becomes a matter of fringe concern. Now, whatever the debt is, Roberts and a few others say $35 trillion. I think it's much, much higher than that. There's certainly not enough dollars in existence to pay any of that back. The regime is going through a lot of trouble to avoid the fact that just recently, interest on the debt is now the number one budgetary item. They're leaving that out in their pie charts about where this money goes. The exchange value of the dollar is in serious trouble. Rise in prices of everything but the dollar is proof of this. You know, Washington can rule over the Japanese or the British using their currencies to buy dollars, but that can't be extended forever. Western central banks aren't willing, as Robert says, to risk the value of their own currencies in support of the American dollar, and the gold and silver, let alone things like Bitcoin, can't be suppressed by simply printing and printing and printing. That's the connection between Russia, Ukraine, and the Great Reset. In fact, the Russian invasion occurred right after the Great Reset was proclaimed. Assets don't actually refer to anything, just like words don't have to refer to an object. It's image producing other images. And none of it ultimately is real. What is real is the blood on the battlefield. This war that was over after a couple of weeks in reality is being artificially dragged on with massive casualties for the Ukrainians. That's the only way that they could repay their debt is through blood. Thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.